Hello, welcome to Therapy Talks. I'm Chris Place and I'm a psychotherapist. In this podcast series, I'll be chatting with different people about their experiences, their lives, their loves, their challenges, and what helps them find their way forward in the world. I'll also chat to different therapists and researchers about the models of therapy that they use to get a better understanding of these different approaches and how these different approaches might be useful at different times for different people. Hopefully it'll be lots of human connection and conversation about the challenges we have and also about what helps us get through. I hope it's going to be fun, enjoyable, entertaining, engaging, informative. Anyway, let's go on the journey. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Therapy Talks. I am delighted to be bringing you my next guest, a psychotherapy student, no less, Amy Harrington. Amy is a graduate of NUI Galway, or should I say University of Galway. She has a degree in psychology and a master's in health psychology, and she's now embarking on her studies in psychotherapy with ICPPD. So I'm delighted to have her here on the podcast to provide an insight into what it's like to train as a therapist or to certainly begin the journey. And the fact that she's in it, she's well-versed in, well-primed to be able to tell us what it's like. Amy, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited to get talking about it.
Yeah.
Especially... I'm doing it every second weekend.
Okay.
So it's a bit like a different world.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of thrown into it. It's such a different experience. And then you have to go about your life during the week like you didn't just have a really profound weekend with like a group of 24 people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit crazy, to be honest.
We were talking beforehand about, I suppose, for anyone who's done psychotherapy trainings will kind of get it, and people who haven't may be kind of like, what? But it's quite a... psychotherapy training is quite an immersive process on a personal level.
Absolutely.
And you get very close to people in your group, typically, who know an awful lot about you in a very short space of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that can be quite an adjustment from a more traditional academic setting.
Yeah, it's a very... it's like a culture shock at first, especially coming from a master's, like coming from a university. It's very academic, very research heavy. But this is like so personal in a way I've never experienced true academia before. Aside from like your friends and stuff, you don't obviously like get that personal. But like even just to start, you had to share your story why you're there. And obviously a lot of people get into psychotherapy for like quite personal reasons, you know, and not a lot of people are like, I want to be a psychotherapist because it looks good on paper and it pays like the bills, you know. So even on like the first day, everyone shared their stories and it was just like, I knew, I was like, whoa, this is like crazy, but good crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's an intensity to it, I think. I suppose I'm always, you know, would say to people, and people would often in the university say, used to talk to me and say, like, I'd like to do psychotherapy, you know, what should I do? And I said, well, get therapy.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, what?
Yeah.
Like, well, because it's a very personal process. And we're sitting with clients who, I think certainly the idea of knowing what it's like to be a client can be an invaluable experience nonetheless. And then obviously when we've all had different experiences that might have led us in this journey, it would be kind of important to look at those experiences and work through them as best we can.
Absolutely, you know. Like I was lucky enough to, I was in therapy before I decided to do it. But to be honest, when I first did psychology in NUIG, University of Galway now, as far as I was concerned, you get into psychology denominated through the psych studies and then you are a psychologist, you can be a psychotherapist. Like I kind of came in with that naivety that that's how you do it, that after the 3 years I could be a psychotherapist. It was only when I was actually in it that I was like, oh, I actually have to do research and SPSS, and it's not just sitting around and talking about like feelings
and
the brain.
You kind of thought that your degree in psychology would be a training in psychotherapy.
Yeah,
in a sense.
That is what I thought at first. And I would, the culture shock of the SPSS and the research, I like was like, oh, okay, like at the start. And like a few other people shared that with me, like in first year, they were kind of like, Jesus, this isn't what I thought it was, you know, kind of thing. But then once you're in it, you're like, okay, like it's still amazing in different ways. But I did come in thinking that I could just walk out and work in a hospital or walk out and be a psychotherapist. It was only in the course that I was like, okay, this isn't going to be the track to where I want to go in this course, but I know to do another course.
So you discover that in your degree, and I mean, I suppose I can relate to it very personally, in that I came back as a mature student to the university in, 1999, 2000, I think, when I was in first year. And I remember that I definitely wanted to do psychology. I kind of had in mind I was going to be a counselling psychologist, and then did a degree, and it was like an immersion in academic rigor, in intellectual kind of, in research in the world of the intellect. And I loved it. It was brilliant. But there wasn't a huge, there really wasn't an awful lot of space for that personal development piece, which I was kind of really itching for. So it was only really when I went and sort of trained that I discovered that side of things. But I think I would certainly feel really grateful that I have my degree in psychology.
I'm the exact same. Like, it wasn't what I thought it was, but I would not be doing psychotherapy today if I didn't do that first. It definitely has given me, like, even just when we're doing the theory, it's all familiar to me. So it does kind of give me that step up in that way. And also they don't, ICPPD don't take people under the age of 24, 25. So I wouldn't have been able to do it anyway. But in hindsight, I wouldn't have wanted to do it, because you can't, I don't think you can go in without a bit of life experience, at least. It was something that was flagged to me in my interview for ICPPD. They were kind of like, oh, like, and why now? And why not give yourself another few years? Because I had just come out of my master's and I shared my life experience, and I'll share a bit with you as well, if you like.
But, that's okay with you.
So when I first went into psychology, or even wanted to, it was because my three youngest siblings have autism. So there would have been a lot in the house of like occupational therapists dropping in, psychologists dropping in and stuff. So I always found it really interesting because I was immersed in kind of like the psychology behind like what's going on with my siblings and why do they function differently from me and my older sibling. I'm one of seven, so there's loads of us.
My question was, how many of you? So you're one of seven, and your three younger siblings all have autism. And then?
And then I have one just below me, Adam, and he doesn't have autism. And then I have two above me who do not have autism.
Okay. So your two oldest and the one next, like, a dozen, and then
the three youngest do
all have autism. Okay.
So it came from my mom has mitochondrial disease, and the kids have mitochondrial disease. So it's something to do with that. It was my mom and my stepdad's genetics together was like a once off.
I'm with you. So your mom and then your stepdad, it was just whatever, it was a once, and
absolute
it was just a
fluke.
Real fluke that that happened.
So straight away I was kind of thrown into like, obviously, like, I was experiencing a different home life from...
It's a different... It's an adjustment, isn't it, from what your home life had been before?
Absolutely,
So what age were you when...
So when Dara was born, I was... He's the first of the three. They thought he had cerebral palsy because he was fisting with his hands and... like they weren't straight away, they were kind of like, okay, he's not doing stuff with his hands that a newborn baby should do, like grasping and stuff. So he was diagnosed with cerebral palsy, and I remember I was in late primary school, I'd say, and I remember not really knowing what was going on, but everyone kind of saying to me, Dara's not well, and I kind of remember being like, oh, this is like really strange. But then and I remember trying to explain to somebody in primary school, my mom said he might not be able to tie his shoes, but like, he's grand. Like, and I didn't grasp like what was really going on. And then Sean was born, and he was fine as a toddler, and as in like no apparent cognitive issues or any or social issues or anything. And then it was only when my mom was pregnant with Lisa, the youngest, that she was called into Temple Street and she was told, some tests have come back. We should have been in touch before now, but it's actually called mitochondrial disease. It's very rare. We don't know much about it. And that's what Dara has. Your son, Sean, most likely has it. And then mom was like, I'm pregnant right now. What about this child? And they were like, that child's going to have it as well.
And they have it because of the the very rare genetic mix. And did your mom have mitochondria?
So yeah, she found out after that she has it, and she actually has a different strain of it. Basically, like whenever my mom goes in to get, she goes in for like reviews in St. James Hospital, and they take out this big notebook and they just go, so what's going on with you now? And write it down. And they don't really know. It's so uncommon.
So it's a very rare disease. And so the strain your mom has then doesn't lend itself to autism. She doesn't have autism. Does she have other challenges as a result?
Yeah, it's mainly the energy. She has very low energy, muscle deterioration, that kind of stuff. Like recently we're actually looking into whether she might actually have autism or not. But again, that's all up in the air. Do you know that at the moment, like, there's a huge conversation around autism and masking and ADHD and stuff.
I think certainly there seems to be more and more people are questioning now and beginning to really explore. And thankfully having this conversation.
But so the kids, so then when Lisa was born, she seemed like she actually didn't have autism, and Sean was delayed in starting to talk.
Okay.
And Lisa actually spoke first, like Dada, Mama.
Yeah.
And she taught Sean how to say Dada, Mama. And they were Irish twins, 9 months between them. Lisa was a whoops. I remember we thought Mom was joking as well, like, because we were like, the other baby is just got here. We were like, and especially because our family grew so fast as well. Wow. Then Lisa just stopped talking and just totally went back inside herself. And then Sean continued to develop, like, his speech and his social stuff. So it was so weird.
So everybody, like Dara, Sean and Lisa, had very different initial manifestations or presentations.
Absolutely. And they still do. Like Dara, he has comorbidity with OCD, which is very common. But Dara is like, he can speak, he can interact in social situations. He's definitely not comfortable in them. He has a very, like, good grasp of social situations. Yeah. And then Sean would be, because is he 14 or 15 now? But he would have the mind of, like, a, like, 7 or 8 year old.
Okay.
Like, very immature, but he's hilarious. Mm. Like, especially because he has the kind of, he loves parroting stuff he watches on TV.
Mm.
So he is so funny. Like, he'll say stuff and you're like, what are you talking about? Like, and it'll be word for word
from
off
something
a movie.
He's seen. Wow.
Yeah, his latest thing is Stranger Things.
Oh wow!
Which is hilarious because he wouldn't. He cut his hair into a bowl haircut in the bathroom.
Cut his own hair.
His own hair came out. We were like, "What have you done to your hair? Please let us cut it."
The bowl haircut is kind of the thing on Stranger Things.
It
isn't
is.
It?
Yeah. So we didn't connect it because he's not allowed to watch Stranger Things because it's scary. So we didn't know he'd watch Stranger Things. We were like, "Where did he pull this from? That he has this bowl haircut?" And then eventually, I sat him down and I was like, okay, I was like, who are you trying to copy? Because he makes movies on his iPad and he is able to, like, word for word regurgitate the movie he watched. It's amazing.
That's incredible.
That's incredible. So I was like, what movie is this?
Yeah.
What is going on? What did you do to your hair? And he was like, don't tell mommy. I've been watching Stranger Things, basically. And I was like, okay, so are you trying to be like Will Byers from Stranger Things? And he was like, yes, I need to be him in my movie. Like, he's so like, why doesn't anybody get the importance of this? And so I ordered him a bowl haircut wig and he let us cut his hair. But
And have the wig then.
And have
the
wig then for the movies. Because, and he has all the Spider-Man suits. all that kind of stuff.
So he's passionate.
Very passionate. And he doesn't understand, it's like he doesn't understand that famous people aren't accessible to him. That kind of social awareness isn't there, because I used to have to message him off an Instagram page and pretend I was Tom Holland, and because he loves Spider-Man. And then it got to the point where he was like, why is he so busy? Like, why can't he text me back? And also, why can't he come and have a sleepover? And no matter how much you explain that he's busy and stuff, he was like, I do not understand why this man can't come have a sleepover. Like, does he not realize we're good friends? So that kind of social awareness isn't there. There's
a social disconnect in a way.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And then Lisa is completely nonverbal.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
it's amazing, isn't it? Like, that she started speaking.
Yeah.
And then it stopped.
Yeah.
And now she's completely nonverbal.
Absolutely. And I remember one day in a lecture in NUIG, somebody actually... We were discussing misconceptions around personality disorders with Sinead Keneally.
Yeah.
And somebody started sharing, they were like, autism is caused by vaccines. And they were like, if a child starts talking and then stops talking, it was the vaccine kicking in. And I remember just being like, no, like that, my sister didn't stop talking because of a vaccine.
I'm just going to say this. Absolutely not the case. Yeah. And there is absolutely that evidence, the vaccine myth, the vaccine scandal.
It drove me crazy. The Wakefield scandal
was absolute bastardization of science on every
absolutely.
Level.
Absolutely. You know? I remember being so frustrated and being like, because I don't even think she started going inward even around the time of vaccine. I remember being so frustrated and wanting to have this out, but we're in a lecture hall of like 200 people.
It's really hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
You're having a very, an experience of somebody's journey and development and changes in their development and witnessing it firsthand.
Absolutely.
And then suddenly somebody might read on the internet that, you know, this expert on YouTube said that.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Absolutely, like, it was very frustrating, and obviously it's a triggering thing as well, because it's so personal to me.
Of course, it's deeply personal.
Yeah, so
deeply personal.
I just that always stands out to me, because I remember just being like, oh my god, it was like one of the many times where the misconceptions around autism like come to the forefront, and it's always people who read it on Facebook and Reddit and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Lisa's
so she's completely nonverbal.
She's completely nonverbal. She is so tall. She's as tall as me. She is my absolute baby. She's spoiled rotten.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes to Brothers in Charity. She is 13.
Oh,
and
wow.
Sean's 14. Or I don't even.
So she goes to Brothers of Charity then.
She goes to Brothers of Charity school. So I remember deciding, I absolutely want to work with children with autism. I have all the skills. I know it all. So when I was in transition year in secondary school, I did work experience in the Brothers of Charity.
Wow.
And I wasn't allowed work in Lisa's class, obviously, because that would totally mess up her routine.
Yeah.
And as you know, routine is everything like for people with autism, and especially my siblings anyway. So I wasn't allowed in her class. But I was getting the bus to school with her to go in. And I remember on the bus, she would be so like, what the hell are you doing on this bus? Like, this is not how this routine goes. But I worked in one of the older classes, like just helping out, like engaging in the like the exercises for the day. What day is it? The songs, the art. And I was exhausted, Chris. It was... is so much harder than I ever anticipated. And then also going home to it was, I was like, okay, that was what made me realize I can't work with children with special needs when I am living it at home.
It's deeply personal then, isn't it? Because you can't really, because you're in it, like you're living it all the time.
Yeah.
And so there's something about, I can really appreciate the desire to say, like, that I have this direct experience and this knowledge from living it with three siblings with autism, and then I can do that. But then you go in and go, I'm exhausted, I'm shattered.
Yes, it's so. And also there's a level of professionalism you need to have, and there's a level of disconnect you need to have that I couldn't have, because I was seeing all these children as my brother and my sister and stuff.
Of course, I mean... I can't imagine how you wouldn't, you know, as a, so it's very difficult to have that sort of you know, go home and sleep at night.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was like, it was just exhausting. And I remember being so in awe of the people who work there.
Yeah.
And their ability to like self-care and disconnect. Yeah. And I remember just being like, how the hell?
Yeah.
So that kind of stifled the going into ABA or going into clinical. I was going
to
say,
so applied behavioral analysis then wasn't going to be the route.
No.
So, okay, so I'm just kind of working this out. So that's like transition, you're going into your leaving cert. Mm-hmm. At that point, were you thinking of psychology anyway? Were
yeah, definitely.
You were on that path, you wanted to work in psychology. And at that point, you were thinking of being like a clinician, therapist slash...
Yeah, so like I was so... Especially from when I was younger, I was so into like self-help books and all that kind of stuff.
What were your favorite books?
I loved Tony Robbins at the time. Tony Robbins, it was a bit of everything. Like I loved spiritual books and then I loved like coaching books.
Okay.
And then like, I remember reading like Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now.
The Power of Now,
Deciding I absolutely am a Buddhist.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about it, but I am. And
I remember in my time, when I was doing my degree, around that time, there was a book called The Celestine Prophecy was written. As well as one of those very spiritual books. And it was like that there are no coincidences and that everyone you meet is giving you a message from some. So I'd be going around the place going, hi. What have you got to tell me?
Yeah. Like,
and then I think I went and studied, so I was doing my degree, and I remember a lecture with Brian Hughes, and I think he talked about coincidences and just things are coincidences. And but I remember at that point my brain was going, oh yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I'm going down an academic route more so. But yeah, interesting.
Because my mom reads tarot cards and is so like spiritual and esoteric that and such a move away from like Catholicism, like and so I was like, oh, this absolutely it, I'm going to be a psychologist who also reads tarot cards and brings this whole other thing to it and stuff. And this was all in secondary school, so obviously this is
amazing.
This is setting me apart from my peers at the time, but also I would always be the one that my friends would come to when they had a problem and they wanted to talk about stuff. And older people would always tell me, you have a young, like an old head on young shoulders. So I remember
wisdom in your years.
I remember being like, oh my God, like I'm going to be this life coach, therapist, and I'm going to blow Tony Robbins out of the water. All this stuff. This is what I had in mind. And I thought I'd just walk in and do psychology and...
That'll be that. Yeah.
And I started having like a really crap time at school. So I stopped going to school altogether.
What was happening? Or?
Like a bit of bullying, a bit of... I just didn't fit in, to be honest. And I always wanted to have like deep conversations, and I wanted to have these really deep friendships, and everyone else was kind of like, okay, this is a bit much, do you know what I mean? Especially like a lot of teenagers, like it was like, you know, you go drinking, you have the boyfriend and stuff, like I just was like such an emotional person at a young age, and I also had so much going on at home,
so there was a lot happening at home, so it was quite, I don't know, it was chaotic.
It was very chaotic. And
what's it like? Can I ask a question? The transition, like there's two lives, isn't there? There's your life before, like, and I know I'm saying it's a, you know, like that, I imagine there's a huge amount of joy with your siblings, but there is a different life before and then a life after.
Absolutely. Like
that adjustment, I imagine that's, you know, when you look at that, you see it in that way.
Like, absolutely. Like even because obviously our whole home life had to be adjusted to the kids. So I couldn't have friends over as easily. I couldn't have like parties or like, because like we always, it just wasn't the normal house. Do you know what I mean? We had to be quiet. Even to this day, like really, I'm so conditioned to go shh, like when the kids are in bed, that even though I now live with my partner, at nighttime I go shh, and he's like, what? Like, and he's like, there's no one else here. And I'm like, oh, okay. Stuff like that still really sticks with me, like so much so.
So you're still, so there's, and so what, you were, remind me just what age were you when, say, Dara was the oldest. Yeah. Dara was born.
So he was born, I think I was 10, I think.
So like the first 8 or 9 years, what were they like? Were they...
They were chaotic in a different way because my mom was a single mom.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
So your dad wasn't...
Yeah, so he lived in Dublin and we went to see him every second weekend.
Okay.
But we were brought up like mainly by my mom and my nanny.
Okay.
And my nanny lived around the corner from us. So we were really, really close. My nanny and my granddad. And my auntie as well, because she lived next door to my nanny and my granddad. So it was kind of like we were raised by a bit of everybody.
Raised by the community in a sense. Yeah. You know, it's like that lovely idea of we're raised by the...
Absolutely, yeah. And then, so I don't really remember a lot of when it was just my mom. Mm. But I know she really struggled. And she felt really unsafe by herself trying to protect 3 kids.
Wow.
So in hindsight, I do kind of remember it now, but I don't know, do I remember it in what she tells me later in life? Because when you're a kid, you're like, my mom has it together. Like, you know, like when you're a kid, you think adults know everything. And then you get to a certain age and you're like, nobody knows what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The great, where we'll be found out, you know. Right now, my son thinks I have it. Well, he's only 8 months. He hasn't figured it out yet. But right now, I'm this wise dude who knows everything.
Absolutely.
And I'll have that for a few years.
Oh, you know, and it's going to be great.
I'll cream off that for a little while, you know. Because it will be taken away.
Yes.
You know.
But and it goes on for so long as well. Like, your parents are obviously like, attachment, all that, they're your whole world.
They are. I mean, we know it from attachment theory. They're a secure basis, like they're
absolutely, you know,
and when that's functioning well, they're important people.
So I was a very, very sensitive child anyway, so I was like picking up on stuff going on, and my parents were trying to figure out co-parenting while going through a divorce and all
it's
that
an
kind
awful
of...
lot of stuff. So I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, because I think it's almost like you were, I'm going to say this, I don't want to sound like, but you were like training to be a therapist from a very young age in a way.
Absolutely.
You're in training, like in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, you were going through this stuff. You had this developed sensitivity that we need in this profession.
Yeah.
I always think that there's a huge issue with, you know, sensitivity is a real power, right?
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing, but it's a pain in the neck.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Absolutely. Like, I'm reading The Highly Sensitive Person at the moment, and I'm just like, oh my God, like, I'm just like, it's so, it just adds a layer to everything else.
Yeah.
Being so sensitive and being so empathetic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very hard to turn off.
It is. And if you can, I mean, I say this from falling many times with this kind of sensitivity, empathic thing, but if we can harness it and then protect ourselves in the process. I mean, Jonathan Egan's stuff on somatic countertransference, all that stuff, that's all the stuff we need to be kind of reading as therapists and thinking about and finding ways to have distance, because the empathy is key for the work in many ways.
Yeah.
It's what we need, but it's a double-edged sword.
You have to be able to turn it off.
Oh, you just, I do. I don't do empathy after 5, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's a joke.
I'm not there yet.
No, I'm... It's a journey. But so you from a very young age then, you had this sensitivity, you were dealing with life stuff that happens in all families in different ways. And in a way that the first part was, you know, dealing with a different kind of parenting arrangement and managing that and all of that stuff. And then you had your, I suppose, your kind of the 3 siblings that came along, and it changed and became something different then.
And it went from... So my stepdad, Jerry, he got with my mom when I was 2 or 3. And I don't remember Jerry not being there.
Wow.
So he's another
dad.
So
he's been there from the beginning, really.
He changed my nappies. So he worked as a fencer. Putting up industrial fences.
Oh wow, okay.
People normally think the swords.
I was just about to go, right, is that a job? Is it a professional? No. Fencer. Okay, that makes more sense,
And we moved from Kildare to Kinnegad because he got a house in the middle of the Celtic Tiger. He bought a house with his job. We all moved in. Then recession hits.
Yeah.
We lose the house.
Oh no.
The kids are diagnosed.
This is all happening at the same time.
This is all happening at the same time. The kids are being diagnosed at the same time.
Wow.
Mom and Jerry are looking at how where are we going to get early intervention for the kids?
Wow.
And the Dublin waiting lists were huge. And so the waiting lists in Galway were not huge.
Wow.
So Jerry had family in Galway, and he was from all over the place. And he, so his mom was living there and his brothers were living there. And so then we moved to Galway, and okay. I was in first year of secondary school.
So when you moved to Galway?
When I moved to Galway.
So your primary school years were in
Leixlip, then Kinnegad.
Yeah.
And then we were moved to Galway, wow. And I rebelled. I was like, you are moving me to the... Can I curse?
Oh, you're allowed to curse. Yeah. You can curse all you fucking like.
To the end of yeah. nowhere.
Oh, that curse. That's, yeah. I thought it was... Sorry, no. I'll edit my F word out yeah. just for any offended. I won't, actually.
No, you
so,
don't need
so,
to.
Yeah. So you moved to the arse end of Galway, nowhere, yeah. the west of Ireland.
I
of
Galway. Was so upset. I had just started secondary school.
In Kinnegad?
I just started secondary school in Kinnegad. I was two oh. months into secondary school, and then I was moved to Gort.
To where? To Gort?
To Gort.
Oh, not even Galway City, to Gort.
No, to Gort. Oh, Jesus. So we lived
right. No disrespect to Gort.
No, big disrespect, no. We lived in Kinvara.
Okay.
And I went to school in Gort.
Okay, so Kinvara is lovely.
It's lovely if you're... old and driving is what I like to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's lovely for a weekend away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But as a teenager, I was so used to hopping on public transport, walking to all my friends' houses, to now living in the middle of nowhere and having to organise lifts to get to these new friends. And I couldn't get the lifts because my siblings couldn't be left alone.
Wow.
So I already was like socially at a disadvantage in terms of like being in the middle of all the socializing.
I
was giving my parents hell. When I was like, we are moving back. I can't believe you did this to me. My life is over. I didn't play camogie. So I was like, what do you expect me to do here? Like, it was the end of the world for me. And I was so sensitive. And I was going through puberty as well. Yeah. So it was
a lot happening.
It was so dramatic. And it was the end of the world. And now in hindsight, the best thing my mom ever did. But at the time, I was like, I will never get over this.
And you did get over it.
Yeah.
And did you adjust to life in the West?
I did in loads of ways, but I never fully fit in.
Okay.
And I used to think that was the coming from an urban, like
urban, rural, kind of.
Yeah. Leixlip and Kinnegad were very similar in terms of like, it was a town, but it was a town that you can walk everywhere.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Me and my friends hung out in the park, and you knocked on your friend's door to ask, were they coming out to play, kind of stuff. Whereas you couldn't do that stuff out in the countryside of Galway. And I was like, I felt like it was a prison. And I was like, I never will socially recover from this. And then also, I was just so sensitive and trying to combat that and being so like emotional and also introspective, and nobody else was doing that. So I remember trying to rein that in all the time and, you know, trying to be cool and like...
Keep that sensitivity down.
Yeah.
Sort of like almost repress
aspects
of myself.
Absolutely. And it was like survival as well. It was like, how do I fit in, protect myself? Because my feelings were always hurt. And it was just, I was just so, like when I look back, it took me therapy to realize that. Like at the time, I was just like, what the hell? Why was I so weird and so sad all the time? And it was, I was just so sensitive. And I had a lot going on at home, and I didn't have the tools to deal with what was going on at home either.
Yeah.
And I remember I used to go to the chaplain in our secondary school, Mrs. Duggan. I haven't spoke to her since I left secondary school, but we used to talk about my siblings.
She was your first therapist.
She was my first therapist, absolutely. And I remember her saying to me, I remember being really upset about what was going on at home and just not wanting to go to class. And she said to me, you need to grieve your little sister. She was like, you thought you were getting a little sister who I could play with, talk to, grow up and have one type of relationship with. And she was like, you need to grieve that. And I remember being like, what the hell are you talking about? I was like, no, I don't. Like, she's not dead. I remember being like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And that was my first experience of therapy and processing.
Wow.
Like, that made me go home and realize, oh, like I am experiencing a loss, even though my sister's there and I have a different type of relationship with her.
It's the loss of another possibility, another way of being. You know, it's kind of having to, and that's a huge transition. Yeah. And I don't think we absolutely understand or give enough energy or emphasis on those transitions and those changes and the adjustments and the grief and the loss. I think it's really important what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I had no tools.
No.
I couldn't self-regulate as a teenager because I didn't know how to. I didn't even know that was a thing.
I didn't know about the window of tolerance.
Yeah. I was like...
So for anyone who wants to... I'll talk about that later. Yeah.
I just thought, like, to be quite frank, I just thought I was a really moody person. Yeah. And I never considered it being sensitivity or like my tolerance or...
Or a kind of an understandable human reaction to what was happening in your life, to having to move, to adjusting to the diagnoses, to coming to terms to a massive change of life.
Yeah.
Do you know, like an understandable reaction.
Yeah.
But in a sense, we weren't really well versed. For many of us weren't well reversed in the language of emotion or in communication of our emotion.
Yeah.
We didn't really know that existed.
No.
We didn't learn that in school necessarily.
Definitely not. And I went through a phase of, I'm going to manifest all these bad feelings away and I'm going to practice the law of attraction so hard that I don't have these bad feelings anymore.
Okay, so the kind of secret and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, the kind of law of attraction stuff, all that. I was like, I can control this and I can get rid of these bad feelings. Okay. And obviously that, instead of like working, I was actually fighting against so much, I was making them worse. Yeah. You know, I wasn't even feeling them. I was like, oh, you can't have a negative thought. You can't have a bad feeling kind of.
So you're operating on a way that's kind of at odds. Like, it's the opposite of processing and it's the opposite of experiencing ourselves. Yeah. It's like, no, I can't have that at all. Yeah. So I'm having to shut myself down in some way. Yeah.
And it made me like really depressed at the time and stuff. Like really depressed.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was reading like Abraham Hicks, like Asking It Is Given and The Secret. And I was reading all those books and remember being like, I'm going to like manifest all this. And it like you get in the way of your manifestations if you feel bad things. And I remember believing it to my core.
It's kind of like victimizing somebody who's already feeling like crap.
Yeah. Oh, wow. My God.
So you get in the way of your manifestations if you feel bad things.
Yeah.
I'm having a reaction. Okay.
Like as now, what I know now, when I think back, I go, oh my Jesus Christ. I'm like, what was I doing to myself? But I was consuming all of these books that I thought would give me the answer, fix me, change my life, make bad feelings or hard times go away. That's what I was searching for in everything that I read and stuff.
You just wanted to feel different and feel better.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then I stopped going to school.
So what year was that around?
That was after my junior cert. I just wasn't fitting in.
Yeah.
I was having boy troubles. I remember like I was having like trying to have these really intense relationships in secondary school and like with teenage boys who aren't fully like developed
being a boy
emotionally.
And being aware of how we boys operate sometimes it's like it's probably not gonna have that deep intense relationship necessarily.
And I was trying to, in hindsight, I was trying to cure my attachment, my insecure attachment at the age of like 17 with a guy who was like, what the hell is this? Like and I remember, well, now looking back, I see I was looking for security in all these places because I couldn't get it from my parents. They were going through so much. And like in hindsight, I'm like, yeah, no wonder I like ran them away. I was like, it was crazy. Like, and I was so, everything was the end of the world and the breakups were devastating and it was all. And then my peers aren't relating to me because they're not having these deep experiences where everything's the end of the world. Like they're getting sad over breakups, but they're not like in the like depths of depression over it. So,
yeah. And so, this is taking you into so 5 years, 6 years kind of time. So you've dropped out of school at the, you're like,
so I hadn't dropped out. No, I just stopped.
You weren't going. Yeah. So you were kind of working from home kind of
basically,
idea.
Yeah.
Didn't go in really much at all for those 2 years, but you did your leave insert.
But I did my leave insert.
And you got the points.
No.
You didn't get the points.
No.
Okay.
So I got 299 points.
Okay, so
I was 1 point off getting arts.
Oh, no way.
I know. So I was like,
oh man,
I have nothing to live for anymore. Oh, I was the most depressed I'd ever been.
Oh dear.
The first time I was ever suicidal.
Really?
It was awful. And I remember going to the doctor and being like, right, I need antidepressants. And him being like, you're just transitioning. Don't worry, like, don't jump to meds. And I was like, okay, well, what am I going to do now? My guidance counselor in school got me into the access course in NUIG.
Okay, great.
So then that was like a year of a level six where you just do different modules.
So you do
modules.
Kind of loads of different modalities, don't you?
And academic writing and stuff.
And you did that like at 18, like just straight, like after you.
I went straight into it, yeah.
Because there's usually quite a lot of mature students who go that route.
Yeah, so there's mature students and school leavers. Wow, and Dr. Mary Sirless was the head of it. I adore her. She, that year I was like, okay, this is my leaving cert. I'm not living at home now. Mm. This is going to be my second chance and I'm not in the middle of the chaos of home and I'm going to get into psychology. And I got the one spot for psychology out of everybody.
There was only one spot.
Yeah, there was only one spot for denominated.
In access.
Through the access course.
Through the access, one spot.
Yeah.
My God,
so I got
amazing?
That spot and I was that, like, to this day, still my biggest achievement ever. Yeah. I remember I was at a music festival in Budapest when I got the CAO results. I was hungover in a tent and I remember opening it and just burst out crying.
Yeah.
And I hugely credit that to Mary Sirless. Like, she was, because she was a secure person for me that year.
It's like, there's a lovely quote, I think it's from Carl Rogers, and I can't remember it, but it's that idea that somebody comes into our life and they provide this, they become like a beacon and like a lighthouse almost. Yeah. And they give us this sort of, and out of that connection, huge healing can come.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing talking to you because I had a thought there. I was thinking, if I had been doing this podcast interview when you were doing your degree, would we be having the same conversation?
Absolutely not.
Do you know? And I think for anyone listening, like, that's the whole idea of this. When you're doing a psychotherapy training, we're are opened and curious and willing to look at our experiences.
Yeah.
Because that's what will help us sit with clients.
Absolutely.
You know? So you get in that one spot. I got kind of a little bit a goosebump there because when I was doing my, I went in through arts and at that time there was 26 places in psychology, but that was it. Like, there was no, you couldn't come in through the leave insert. Yeah. So everyone competed through arts. And I came in as a mature student and I didn't really think I had any academic potential at all.
Yeah.
And, but whatever, anyway, I remember doing Sock and Paul, classic civ, philosophy and psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I got it. I mean, I got in, I did well. And I remember getting the results. I was on holidays in West Cork with an ex-girlfriend of mine and our two families, or my two mums, we're all in the garden, it was sunny, and I got this, and I couldn't do it. I said, like, open it. And it was just, I remember running around in my shorts going, ah. It was like the best feeling. To this day, like, it's probably the last,
feeling like
I still
it.
Think of like that achievement of getting into psychology.
Absolutely. You know? It was, but so I got in and I remember being like, finally I'm on track.
Yeah.
But then I had the worst imposter syndrome ever because I was like, everyone in this room got 600 points and they're going to catch me. And I used to always think about the show Suits and the guy Mike being a fake lawyer. And I used to always be like, they're going to catch me.
They're going to catch me out.
Yeah, they're going to catch me out. And I remember on one of the first days, one of the lectures, one of the year heads, was like, and there's somebody here who came from the access course. And I remember being like, shut up, like, do not out me on my first day. And then I remember I just let her gloss over it and she went, maybe they're not here yet. And then after class I went up and I just said, oh yeah, that's me, by the way, thanks. And I remember just being like, I'm getting caught on the first day, but
so there's almost this idea that somehow being from access was a less than,
yeah,
and if anything it mean, it's so far the opposite.
Yeah, like in hindsight, I see that now. And I wouldn't have been able to do psychology without the access course because the academic writing modules, the study modules, it taught me how to do university. And I was like, everybody should have to do this.
That's one of the big issues, I think, is that people come in from school without that.
Mm-hmm.
And because I know for me, when I started, I was going, how do I write an essay? Yeah. You know, and I immersed and I was curious and I was eager and I was sitting at the front of the lectures putting my hand up.
Yeah.
You know, I was one of those people. Yeah. I remember. But when I was 18 and doing business studies in the RTC or GMIT or whatever, the Atlantic Technical Institute University, I was down the back messing. So, so you go into psychology, you work through your imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Do you find it a positive experience, your degree?
Yes and no. It, obviously my mental health struggles came with me.
Okay.
So there was a lot of that, and you're really finding out who you are in college.
Yeah.
So much so. And I found psychology really, really hard.
Yeah.
I found the theory modules lovely because I knew how to write an essay.
Yeah.
I knew, like, I just find my points. I had my pair, like, so anagram thing.
What was it, the stuff that you found hard then in particular?
The research stuff.
So, like, the kind of SPSS type stuff?
The SPSS, knowing which test to run. Yeah.
So, just for anyone who's listening and doesn't know, SPSS is a statistical package software, basically. And for people who've done psychology will know that you have to do this, you have to do a study, like a project, and you have to do an SPSS, and like I just have cold sweats.
Yeah.
Some people are really good at it and some of us aren't so good at it. So that was something that you struggled with.
And my biggest saving grace is David Comer. Shout out to David. He's still one of my best friends today. He's doing his PhD in NUI, University of Galway now. He carried me through the SPSS.
Well done, David.
Yeah, David, shout out to David, always. We always
hope you listen to this, David. Yeah. Hope you listen to this.
He will be.
Yeah.
We always say my degree needs to have my name, but his name in little writing at the bottom as well. Yeah, yeah. He was, oh my God. And I'm so glad he's doing the PhD because he's getting to teach people. And he's an amazing teacher.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So that's what we need. Lots of people who can teach.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a real art, it's a real skill to be able to communicate these ideas and to be able to make something understandable.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. So then I'm in college, I'm pottering through, I'm getting by with my friends, with a little help from friends.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic hits in third year.
So you had done, I'm trying to think, because I think I taught you at some point.
Yeah, you taught me in second year. Actually, let's not gloss over that.
Well, no, I'm not trying to, so hey, everyone. Yeah. No, but I know that you had emailed me and mentioned that I had taught you, and I think I taught you therapy skills or something like that, with professional skills.
Professional skills,
So that, but that was, so I'm trying to remember a timeline, that was 2019 then.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it was 2019. Yeah. I'll never forget because that module was my first time seeing how to get to psychotherapy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I remember being like, oh, like being like, this is such a good module. I never missed it because I was like, this has the answers. Like, this is the good stuff now. And then, so.
She's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Emma, joke.
And I'll never forget because this is why you stick out to me so much, because not only you're an excellent teacher and you always had the crack with us, which obviously made it more enjoyable. But I remember I was late for class one day and I texted David and I was like, has class started? I'm running late. And I put my phone in my pocket, running through the concourse, the big hallway in NUIG.
Yeah.
And I didn't see my message until I sat down, but David had texted me back and he said, Chris said, whoever is next late in class, he's going to mess with them when they walk in.
Oh, God.
But I did not see the message. So I walk in and everyone went quiet and you just stared at me.
Oh,
and I just went, hello. And you went, hello. And then I walked all the way down to the end of the class and you just looked at me and everyone started giggling. And I was like,
oh no,
what is going on?
Oh,
and then when I sat down, everyone just burst out laughing and he went, I know, I'm only messing. I just wanted to scare whoever was the next person who was late to class.
Oh, dear.
And we all burst out laughing.
Okay, that was okay, was it? I feel like I'm going to be taken before some tribunal or something like
no,
that.
No, it was so funny. Yeah. And even that, like that,
I certainly wasn't trying to shame
anyone. No, it was having the crack. Yeah. Like, there was a different day. You were like, okay, whoever's going to be late today when they walk in, I'm going to tell them it's my birthday or something like that. And like, just... we all loved it. It was very funny.
So I'm squirming here. Yeah. This is really uncomfortable for this podcast. So I was like, oh God. I don't know what comes out of my mouth sometimes. But anyway.
But it was it was entertaining. That's why we loved it.
Okay.
But no, I thought that was so funny. And when I sat down and then I read the text and I was like, oh my God, you couldn't have like texted me a bit sooner to give me the heads up.
But it was funny.
It was very funny. And that was the first time. Another memory from that module was... you were like, okay, we're going to do an exercise where somebody sits down and they're... You were the first person to ever show me active listening.
Okay.
That was my first introduction to active listening. Oh, wow. Because as far as I was concerned, as a therapist, I was going to sit across someone and tell them how to fix their problems and not listen to them in particular. Like, get a little bit of what's going on and then tell them how they're going to fix it.
So sort of more of an expert model.
Yes.
You know, I'm so glad I'm not doing that because I'd be rubbish at it. I get it wrong the whole time, do you know, because I really wouldn't have a clue how to fix somebody.
Yeah.
I can barely do that to myself. But what I do like the idea is that we can facilitate and work and collaborate and find a way through together.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Absolutely.
So that was something different for you to have that kind of experiential learning piece.
Yeah. And then I remember being like, oh shit, like, I have it all wrong. And I remember being like, how am I going to sit on my hands and not talk? Because I'm a talker. And
me too.
Then I remember you did an exercise where you said, okay, somebody is going to come up and they're going to practice active listening and I'm going to tell them problems and they're going to active listen.
So they're going to be my therapist.
Yeah, they're going to be the therapist. Yeah. And I remember you didn't say therapist. It was just really, is what active listening is.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, this is framing it like that was great because like you can use it for anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like even I remember being like, okay, yeah, qualitative research.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think for qualitative researchers, active listening is the way.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, yeah.
And so one of the girls in the class volunteered first and you were like, okay, somebody has to tap her out and then they hop in.
That now, yeah.
And nobody tapped her out. Everyone was so scared and she did it for ages. And I remember I so badly wanted to have a go.
Wow.
And I was just like, no, I can't risk this in front of everybody. I can't be that person.
Wow.
And to this day, I still think about it. I still think, oh my God, like I wanted to do it so desperately.
Do you know what's really interesting? Like thinking about that for 1 second, like, so just the juxtaposition between that there and now you're sitting here doing a podcast with me and you're talking very openly in front of hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm exaggerating for effect, but you know, in front of my mother.
And mine.
And yours. Yeah. Hi, mums.
Yeah.
There's a real honesty and there's something in it, isn't there, that you knew that you wanted to be able to come up and participate and communicate and speak.
Yeah.
And that's the journey you're on. Right?
Yeah. That module made me realise that is what I want to do.
Wow.
It was you and another, and I forget the man's name. He worked for the counselling services for the college.
So
and he was so gentle. He was the loveliest
James
man.
James McCormick, no?
Maybe.
Or it could have been, he's the head of counselling now.
I think he wears glasses.
Yeah, James. It's James. James do stuff. He wears glasses. And he's just the loveliest of men.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And I remember him teaching and talking about therapy and that you have to choose a course that's accredited. And I remember being so excited and just being like, this is what I want to do. Yeah. Like, this is it. They're finally giving me the answers. And then they were like, so yeah, and you do another like 3 or 4 years. And I was like, sorry. I'm just doing 3 years. I was like, and I remember being like, oh my God, like I'm going to be 50 by the time I'm actually in my career.
Yeah.
And then lockdown happened.
Yeah.
So
that's in your third year. So you go to third year.
Yeah.
Do you remember, were you in the college when it happened? Were you there?
I was. Yes, I was.
We were doing resilience. We had been doing these resilience workshops. And myself and another therapist, Gemma McNally, and we had started 2018, 2019, I can't remember we started them, maybe it was 2019, 2018, and we were running these workshops with commerce students, mm-hmm. and it was this kind of, it was with Padraig McNeila, and then lockdown happened.
Yeah.
And suddenly it was like, I'd just go home.
Yeah.
I remember going to the canteen for the last supper, like.
Yeah,
literally went
same.
In going, what's happening?
I'll never forget that email, so the college is closing at 5 for 2 weeks.
So do you remember Leo Varadkar's, so me and Gemma somehow missed, we missed the first part.
Yeah.
And we were like, all right, that's grand. He had just said everything shuts down today from 5, but we missed that.
Yeah.
And we were like, and everyone's going, we have to leave. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Oh, that was shivers.
Oh my God.
Still get shivers.
It was like, I remember being like 2 weeks off. Yeah. That was everyone's thing. I'm back to college in 2 weeks. And I remember being like, oh, please say my exams are online. And then we're back in September.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I had in my mind.
Yeah.
So we go into lockdown. I moved in with a boyfriend at the time for lockdown.
Not your present?
Not my present boyfriend.
A different boyfriend.
And it was a really emotionally toxic relationship, which was accelerated by lockdown.
I can only imagine, yeah.
And then, buckle yourself in, Chris.
Okay.
So, he's buckled in.
I'm ready.
My brother Adam is just below me. He got lymphoma. And he was the one sibling of Mam and Jerry who didn't have autism or mitochondrial disease. But God was like, I have to give him something.
Jesus.
And then...
He got lymphoma
in just at the start of lockdown. And then that summer, Jerry passed away.
Oh.
I know.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
Oh, dear.
It makes me emotional even talking about it.
Yeah.
But
Jerry passed away. And was that sudden? Or?
It was out of nowhere. He was under so much stress from taking care of the kids. The pandemic, because mitochondrial disease is immunocompromised.
Yeah, of course it is. So, you're the fear.
And then when Adam got sick, I think it was just too much stress. And the feeling in the family was like, what did we do in a past life? Like, how can one family be so unfortunate? So that was the catalyst for me to leave that relationship.
Yeah.
And that was a huge, like, the beginning of truly beginning to heal was that year, 2020.
Wow. 2020 was a deep dive then.
Yeah,
really, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And it was like, if there was ever a time something was going to throw me into the process, it was that year.
So you had no choice, really. So, like, you're being thrust into it. So the relationship ended. This really emotionally toxic. Jerry passes away.
Yeah.
And Adam is...
Has lymphoma. He has cancer, yeah. Adam's in remission now, touch wood.
Great. So Adam is doing okay?
So yeah, Adam's doing great. He's in GTI now. He's a little punk rocker now, covered in tattoos and piercings. No, he has red curly hair.
Oh, very cool.
He's very...
Like dyed red or just red?
Dyed red.
Oh, very funky.
So I move home with Mam.
Yeah.
And me and my two older brothers get together and we were like, how are we going to care for our siblings?
Yeah.
Continue living our life and make sure that Mam survives this. Because her and Jerry were both carers, because in Ireland, you can only be a carer for two people at a time. He was 51.
51?
Yeah.
I'm 51. Oh, Christ.
I know.
That's just terrible.
It was...
incredibly, just a shock to the
system. I'll never forget it. I got the call. My brother rang me and said, Dad's like on the floor, he passed out, the ambulance are working on him. And I remember, like, it was like in a movie that, like, when your ears go underwater. And I got the boyfriend at the time to drive me home. And I remember on the way home, I got the text that he was already gone. And I remember I just started screaming and screaming and screaming. And my ex-boyfriend was driving so fast. And a car pulled out and we did like a donut up the road. It was like 2 a.m.
Jesus.
And then he just adjusted the car and kept driving. Like, I was so in shock. It didn't even faze me. And my mom's sister rang me and was just like, I was screaming down the phone and I was like, this isn't happening.
Yeah.
And she was like, you need to get yourself together before you get home to your mom. Like, just get yourself together before you get home to your mom. Like, don't go in the house screaming. Mm. And I came into the house and my mom was on the floor. Oh, God. And I just sat down to my mom and I was just, she says, this is all she remembers to this day is I knelt down and I was like, we are going to get you through this. You are going to be okay. Because like my mom struggles with her mental health as well. And I was like, my first thought is like, she's not going to make it through this. She is not going to make it through this, because they were like, that was her best friend, her partner in crime. Like it was unimaginable. Like, and then it was like COVID and like it was all just so like the doctor had to come out and pronounce him dead, but like there was all these restrictions going on. It was just crazy. And then I remember they questioned Adam, the guards did, because they had to make sure there was no foul play, and they were like, why are you sleeping in a room with your dad? Because he looked like a grown man. He was bald. And he was only 18 or 19. And he goes, because I have cancer. And then they went, oh, shit. Like, and they totally backtracked. They thought, like... And then I remember mom just being like... Ugh. Like, it was just crazy. And then the next few weeks, it was like... My parents never wanted Lisa in respite because... I don't know, was it pride or was it protection? But one of the scandals had come out where in one of the care homes, abuse had come out. Yeah. And when that came out, I remember Mom and Jerry were like, they are never going into care. Okay. We can't trust people, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And when Jerry died, we were like, we have to put Lisa into respite. And then my mom couldn't get respite for her. And it was just like, I remember calling social workers and doing all this, and coped by going into go, go, go. Week Jerry died, I cleaned the house. Yeah. I just couldn't stop. And like, caring for my sister, like she's as tall as me, but she's still a nappy. So having to do that kind of stuff, I was like, okay, I'm just going to keep going so I don't have to stop and be like, well, what the hell just happened?
Wow.
Then, so mom couldn't get respite for Lisa, so she had to go on like a social media campaign.
Really?
So that's what got her out of bed, which I'm very grateful for, is she went on like News Talk and the newspaper.
Wow.
And basically was like, this just happened to me. My kids are sick and I can't get respite. What the hell is wrong with like...
with our country.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, Lisa got respite. She gets 2 nights a week. And everything started putting wheels in motion. And then this all happened during the summer. I then had to go into my final year of college in September. And I remember grappling so much.
Into your third year.
Into my third year. And I remember dealing with
all of this.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I remember being like, how the hell am I going to leave mom? Yeah. And I remember being like, I need to kind of step away to do college. And my two older brothers were going out more than I was. And then you feel guilty because you're not there. But I also needed to finish my degree.
Yeah.
So I moved in with a group of girls. And then I had my final year in lockdown, full of grief. And we were all just in this house together in Salt Hill. And it was the weirdest year ever.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Jesus.
And
talk about like an utter roller coaster. Like, I mean, I'm still kind of I'm usually not at a loss for words, but I am. I think like my dad died in 2021, and I remember that feeling. And I remember that feeling of, you know, I remember cleaning 3 cars in the driveway. Could have just brought them all down, but for some reason I had to clean these cars and cleaning. And I remember that the feeling that takes us over, you know. But like that, you were dealing with all this other stuff on top of just grief.
Yeah.
Do you know? And then all of the process after, and then you have to go back and do your degree.
Yeah.
And it's lockdown and you're stuck in a house in Salt Hill.
Yeah.
And did you get on with the women?
I love the girls a little bit. Great. And that was like, I still got the touch of like the college experience.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I was so full of grief that year.
Yeah.
And no one else in that house had lost a parent.
No. I mean, it changes. When you lose a parent, something shifts. Something changes fundamentally inside, I think, that, do you know?
Yeah.
And good Lord, like, so then your degree, your final year is in lockdown. You're doing it online.
Yeah.
You're in this house in Salt Hill with these lovely women, mm-hmm. lovely girls that you're really well, a really good relationship with.
Yeah.
But you're grieving.
Yeah.
And grief is a fecker. Like, grief just comes. Yeah. I was thinking about grief before I was talking about it in an earlier podcast. But it's like, sometimes it's like a little ripple and it's sometimes like a juggernaut.
Yeah.
Do you know? You can Absolutely. Be walking along and suddenly you're on the ground.
Yeah.
And another time it's just like, and then carry on.
And I would, like, humour was my coping mechanism. Yeah. Like, dark jokes. And then the following year, David, who is my friend from college, his dad passed away.
Oh, dear. Is this David the...
This is David Comer, the PhD.
The PhD, wow.
The genius.
The genius,
So that was really nice in terms of, like, that bond us like nothing else.
Yeah, like, he certainly knew, didn't he?
Yeah.
He knew.
And we joked, like, we would have awful jokes and really dark humour. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, you cursed me. Like, you gave me the dead dad curse. And I was like... sorry about it, like, my bad. And so that was a great...
Having the dark humour can really help an awful lot. Oh, it can help us sort of conceptualise it, make sense of it, move it. It's invaluable, actually.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And before Jerry passed away, I had just started with a new therapist.
Okay.
Shout out to Donna Larkin. I love her. You went to school with her, I think.
I think I am older than Donna.
Yeah.
I think I remember possibly being on the same housing estate, and I think Donna was a couple of years behind. And I have a vague feeling that Donna emailed me a number of years ago about looking for a placement. We didn't have that capacity or availability at the time. And now she's my therapist. Well, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And Donna, it's been many years, but how are you?
Yeah.
I don't know what she listened to this, but anyway.
Element Health, I hope I get that right. I told her I'd give her a shout out.
Element Health.
Yeah, Crest Element Health.
Crest Element Health are competitors. Okay, thank you very much. I'm only joking, but, of course.
She specialises in adolescents.
Wonderful. Brilliant. But, that's really good, and certainly good for me to know somebody for referrals.
Yeah,
so I'd
absolutely.
Like to, I might talk to you about that afterwards.
Yeah. So
you found your therapist, Donna.
Yeah. So I started with her because I wanted... to stay in the unhealthy relationship I was in.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, if I could be less sensitive, I could survive this relationship.
I could change myself.
Yes.
And deal with the toxicity in a better way.
In a better way.
That would be a healthier thing to do. That makes sense.
That just makes sense on paper. A great idea.
Yeah.
So I remember she was like maybe my third or fourth therapist. I'd been in and out of counseling a few times, but never stuck.
Mm.
And I started with her on the phone, so we never met in person. So we were like pen pals for a while, and then I'll never forget the day two days after Jerry died, she rang me for a phone call therapy session, and I was like, hello, and she was like, hi Amy, how are you doing today? And I went, oh Donna, my dad died, I can't talk right now.
Oh my god.
And I remember she was like, oh I'm so sorry, you know. And I was like, okay, I have to go, bye. Like, I remember it was because I was in Dunn's and I was doing the food shop for my mom.
Yeah.
And I had my two brothers with me, and Dara had a panic attack, and he never had a panic attack before. Uh-huh. And I was like, okay, we got to pack the shopping and I need to get him outside. Mm. And I kind of sat him down and I was like, he was like, I can't see and I'm going to faint and I can't breathe.
Mm.
And he just thought he was dying. But I was like, this is a panic attack. Don't worry. Like, we'll get you some Coke. We'll sit down. And then, like, it was just such a crazy time. Like, when I look back, it was just survival.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so much in it, isn't there? It is just this idea of survival. So I'm kind of curious. So you go to therapy and realize, I'm guessing through the therapy, you realize that staying in that relationship was not a useful strategy.
Yeah. Well, when I look back now, we laugh about it because I used to say to her, what do you think I should do?
Mm.
Why won't you tell me what I need to do?
Mm.
And now as somebody who's training as a therapist, I'm like,
Well, because we can't know. Like, yeah. It's that thing. If I say, you know, use is what you need to do. Yeah. That's from my frame of reference. Yeah. That's from my experience. Yeah. And that's very different to yours. So that's, so you're, okay. So you're having this really like positive therapeutic experience.
Mm-hmm.
You've met a therapist that you've clicked with.
Yeah.
You're on the journey now.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this stuff is happening. So much is happening. Your dad dies, you know, all of it's happening. Mm-hmm. And so you leave that relationship eventually, I'm guessing?
So after my dad dies, I leave that relationship because it kind of highlighted for me, like, well, I'm not going to get any support in what's going on. So I'm better off going through this alone. And I knew I shouldn't have been in it anyway. You know,
but you don't want to know.
But you don't want to know. Yeah.
So you... Then, because I suppose I'm thinking of, you know, the timeline away, and then you're doing a master's in health psychology.
So this is all going on in my final year.
Yeah.
And I remember just letting the lecturers know, here's what's going on, and give me grace, please.
Yeah.
And everyone in the psychology department was so supportive.
Yeah, they're great.
A major shout out to, do you know Nikki Warner?
I know who she is. Yeah.
She taught me SPSS and I remember emailing her and being like, we're spreading my dad's ashes, can't do the exam. And she sent me the most gorgeous email talking about how her mom passed away during her master's.
Oh, Nikki, I do know Nikki.
And Nikki's now one of my really good friends today.
Wow.
But between her and David.
So how kind and how lovely that she could send that. And
it was beautiful.
So you've had this, you have these amazing support systems and you get through your degree.
Yeah.
And you get into health psychology.
And I get into health psychology. And then, I don't know, am I allowed to say this? I kind of just did health psychology because that's what I thought I was supposed to do.
Yeah. So why aren't you allowed to say it?
I don't know. Isn't that like, that reflects bad on the college or something? I don't know.
Well, like reflect badly on the college because...
I don't know, I guess. I feels a bit shameful to say, oh, I just did it for the sake of it, because what a privilege that I got to do it.
Yeah, but like we do things, don't we? We do things, oh, I'll give this a go.
Yeah.
And it is a privilege.
Yeah.
And we can actually honour it. It's a privilege that we get to do it. But it doesn't mean it's going to be our life's calling.
Yeah.
Do you know?
So I did it and I spent the whole year being like, this, like, it just isn't doing it for me, basically. Like, it was interesting, and I really enjoyed my health module in my undergrad, hence why I decided I would do it.
Yeah, and I loved health psychology in my degree, and I had seriously considered doing health psychology. Yeah. No, I'm glad I didn't, but, you know.
But everyone around me was like, what master's are you doing? And I was like, oh, yeah, what one are you doing? And David picked that one, so I picked that one as well. Yeah. And I remember in hindsight, seeing like well-being masters and stuff colleges in Dublin, and I think a massive part of it was I was so comfortable in that college.
Yeah.
I had such support in the School of Psychology as well.
Just from a career point of view, without digressing, having a master's in health psychology is going to add to your kind of, it will add to what you do.
Yeah.
Like it's a really valuable, like there's some really valuable models and research that you're doing that has value and we can learn from and can inform us in the therapy, you know.
Yeah.
So I think I wouldn't be dismissing it by any means.
I definitely don't dismiss it now, but I do feel like, oh, when I went into it, I was just like, I really was like, oh, I'm supposed to be, I looked around and I was like, I'm supposed to be doing this.
Yeah.
And I found it really hard that year because I was going back and forth between, should I stick this out? Should have a master's.
Yeah.
And I was really struggling with my mental health for all of that year. And college is impossible when you're struggling like that.
Yeah. So it was really hard, isn't it? You've got all this stuff going on and you're trying to do your master's, trying to focus on stuff that is not important, and it is important, if that makes sense. Do you know, it's important in a sense because I'm here.
Absolutely.
You're dealing with things that are far more profound.
And I remember, like, I just didn't go to college for a few months, and then I came back and I was like, no, I do want to finish it out. And like everyone in School of Psychology was so supportive, and this, like, the same Nikki was one of my lecturers through the health psychology, but like she also was like supporting me so much. And the same with David. like just are so blessed in the people I found along the way.
And it's amazing then, isn't it? I'm conscious of time, and I'm conscious of, so we started with your training to be a psychotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of going to end in with that in a sense, mm-hmm. because that's what you did then.
Yeah.
Like you did your master's and you said, right, I have to do psychotherapy training.
Yeah.
That was pretty much it. Was it like a pretty...
It was, yeah, without a doubt.
Did you go straight from the master's in
straight into it, yeah.
And you're now in first year.
Yeah.
You're able to articulate and talk about these experiences in part because of the training you're doing now.
Absolutely.
You know, for people who don't know, when you're in psychotherapy training, one of the things you do is group therapy.
Yeah.
So you sit around with other people and you work through these issues mm-hmm. that you have that often will get... When we have issues with other people, for example, mm-hmm. it's often because of our own issues.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of projection and so on. So you're doing all of this profound work and you're learning about all of these ideas and these skills and different things, which enables you to sit here and talk very honestly and openly.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, and like we like to say, it's like open heart surgery.
Yeah.
Like you're coming in and you're, it's for the better good, the surgery is, but it's an open wound and you're just, it's like once you open it, you can't go back.
No, I remember that feeling as well. Once I started, I went, I mean, for me, it had started years before in a way because I got overwhelmed with anxiety and then it was like suddenly discover therapy, but it discovered it in a way that like things had been opened.
Yeah.
And that was it. I had no choice.
Absolutely.
You know?
And I was so having such a positive experience with Donna and the way she did therapy.
Yeah.
And I went, what course did you do?
Did she do ICPPD?
And she did ICPPD and she did the holistic counselling and psychotherapy.
So that's the 4-year one, isn't it? Or,
yeah.
So is that what you're doing then?
That's what I'm doing now. Yeah. So when she told me what she did.
Degree.
Yeah. When she told me what she did, I went, I want to do that one. I love what you're doing. Like, I remember just being like, I want to do what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then I applied for it and I remember being like, how the hell am I going to pay for it? And I went to the credit union and I was like, I will move mountains. I was so certain it was what I wanted to do.
Wow.
And then when I did my interview, I remember them being like, oh, like you're a bit young. Like, why now? Mm. And I remember being like, well, my dad died and my brother has cancer and my siblings are sick and blah, blah. And I was like, I just think I have enough life experience.
Yeah.
And I remember the lady who was interviewing me said, okay, you definitely have more experience than some of the 50-year-olds who I give counselling to. I was like, I think you'll be just fine, like, coming into this. And I remember being, like, delighted, like, because, like, I wanted them to know that I wasn't coming in with, like, naivety. Like, I was already there in the process through my own therapy. And then when I got in, I remember thinking, like, I don't know who I thought I was going to be with. And then it's like the most diverse group of 24, like of all ages. I'm the baby of the class. And it is just, I can't even put into word, like the bond you form so quickly is just like, I've never, the reason like I was like, oh, I'd love to talk about this on the podcast is because like, I feel like if everybody got to experience this kind of relationship that I get to experience in my class, the world would be such a better place.
Yeah.
Like the willingness to openly communicate, to honestly share, to hold each other. It's just, it's like when I come home after college, like on a weekend, like my boyfriend is like, so what'd you get up to today? And I'm like, blah, 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 blah. Like, I'm like, I can't share enough how.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because for somebody who has immersed themselves in academia for the last number of years, and that, you know, you've learned how to write a really good essay and to do research and to do all those really important things.
Yeah.
And then you're doing this, you're exercising this other muscle, this deep, like this heart muscle. I don't know what part of our brain or whatever, the limbic system is firing all over the place. And you're doing that deep work. It's like, there's a refreshingness to it. Like it's
absolutely.
Like even watching you and the journey being on in this podcast and like your animation now, your sense of like, I love this.
Yeah, it, like it, I get so excited when I talk about it. It's so fulfilling in a way that I've never experienced with anything else before.
So like, do people say, maybe studying psychology now or doing other courses or doing whatever, who are kind of interested in this, would you say it's worthwhile?
Oh, absolutely. I would. Yeah. There's some people in my class who are doing it purely for personal development. Yeah. They have no interest in going on to be a counsellor career-wise.
They're doing it for their own
journey. They're doing it for, and it's like, I'm like, if everybody could do this, like if I don't go on to be a counsellor, which I plan to, but if I don't, I will have gained 4 lifetimes of treasures from this course. Wow. Like, it has changed the way I communicate with everybody in my life. It's changed the way I see the world. Wow. It's changed how, it's reframed how I look at everything I've ever been through. And it's just, like, you get this selfishness of, like, I'm working out my own stuff. But also to be able to help other people is, like, just how exciting. Even in class, like, people have, like moments of, oh, my God, like, when we're all just practicing skills on each other. And then, like, even seeing that, like, you, like, help somebody or they help you afterwards, you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it's so profound. It's just really cool. Like, and it's really hard to talk to people who aren't in it about it and get them to truly get how profound it is. Because, like, you name, like, your triggers. You're so honest with people.
So there's a really authenticity then, isn't it? And I mean, the idea of, you know, Carl Rogers talks about in therapy, one of the things we need to do is be genuine.
Yeah.
That we bring this authenticity to the table. And that's actually easier said than done.
Oh, yeah.
And so to be really real means you have to experience that. Like, so to apply, you know, we take those core conditions of therapy and we take it from the book, the textbook, into a real lived experience and meeting someone in a very real and authentic and genuine way.
Yeah.
Like, that's why we do these courses. Yeah, and that's why we do this work.
Yeah. Like, it's changed the way I interact with, like, a shopkeeper. Like, it's changed. Like, I found myself, I was working in retail, I found myself having deeper conversations with the customers. Like, it just, it, like, it opens up a new way of just interacting with people.
It feels to me like you're coming home.
Yeah.
Do you know, like, you're coming home to that girl who we talked about at the start, who was really sensitive.
Yeah.
And was not knowing that there was a language for that. And here you are, where that sensitivity is celebrated.
Yeah.
And is invited and is validated and is fundamental to the work.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of putting it.
Do you know?
Yeah. It's the first time in my life I've ever showed up as 100% myself.
Yeah.
And been so unconditionally met with unconditional positive regard. Like, it's my first experience of, like, truly, truly being myself and having such a positive reaction and such a safe place to be held in that.
And I suppose I'm really grateful that you are on this podcast and that you brought that honesty to this podcast. Like, there's something really moving and really powerful, and yeah, it's just wonderful.
Thank you.
So thank you. I genuinely mean it. Like, it's been, and I am conscious, like, it's now 2:30 and we've gone over it. Usually, but it's fine. I don't even going to edit anything out of this. I can't. It's like a, you know, it's just a conversation.
Yeah.
Is there anything else before we finish?
No, just the reason I messaged you to come onto this podcast, I just want to have more conversations like this in all areas of my life. And I just as I said, once you open the lid, you can't stop. So once I start connecting with people like this, and because I listened to your podcast, I knew, like, even as you said, you like to let the conversation flow. You hope human connection happens.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that'd be how lovely would it be to sit down and record a connection, you know?
And I mean, like, we could talk for another 5 hours, you know, and I suppose I'm. How are your family now? How is everybody doing?
Yeah, they're good. It's still, my mom is amazing, as always. And we've kind of figured out a routine. And she's met somebody now.
Oh, great.
And Joe is his name. And he's I'm just, so there,
there's,
lovely.
There's sort of, yeah. There's like green shoots emerging.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's amazing with the kids. And
lovely.
Mom's going through her own journey now of like her process as well.
Yeah, wonderful.
And the kids are, they're figuring it out. Like, as we all are, we're all just figuring it out.
Oh, as they say, there's green shoots emerging all yeah, around the place.
Absolutely.
So look, thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you like for having me.
It's been brilliant. So to everyone listening, I hope you've enjoyed this conversation with Amy. I certainly have.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope I didn't talk the ear off you guys.
Not at all. And listen, thanks everyone for listening. And we'll talk to you all next time.
Next time. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.